And I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio, and you're listening to Rag Radio on solar-powered, free-range, cooperatively run, all-volunteer community radio station, KOOP 91.7 FM in Austin. Rag Radio is also rebroadcast on several other stations around the country, and our podcasts are posted a couple of places, and the show has legs. So a lot of people listen to us all over the world, actually. So that's all very cool. Tracy Schultz is my engineer and also is our choreographer. This is we're in the middle of our spring membership drive. Thank you, Tracy Schultz. Roger Baker is here also, the inimitable Roger Baker, who's taking pictures, and Scott Crow is my guest. Scott Crow is an anarchist, author, and activist, and many, many other things, including a musician. Scott Crow is an international speaker, author, and storyteller who is a proponent of the ideas and practices of anarchism. For almost three decades, he has been active as a political organizer and educator, co-op business founder and co-owner, filmmaker, and musician. He is the author of the critically acclaimed book, Black Flags and Windmills, Hope, Anarchy, and the Common Ground Collective from PM Press. And it's a remarkable book, and it's a remarkable book about a remarkable event at a remarkable time and the Common Ground Collective's efforts there, which Scott was very much involved with, are legend now. So, you know,
I can't own that. They set the bar way too high.
I can't even reach the bar up there. You got to pull the bar down for me a little bit. So, that book, incidentally, was chosen as an NPR summer read in 2015. Has been translated into Spanish and will be translated soon into Russian. So, another book. His book that we have with us here. And Scott's book is, this is the newest book, mm-hmm. Emergency Hearts, Molotov Dreams, a Scott Crow Reader, Selected Interviews and Conversations, 2010 to 2015. So this is a historical document, ladies and gentlemen. Scott Crow is frequently featured in international media, including the New York Times, Democracy Now!, CNN, blah, 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 and blah. And has been involved in an incredible number of projects. And he also has been our guest at least once before on Rag Radio in 2011, I guess just the once. Mm-hmm. And that's way too long between visits.
You're so busy.
Busy man. Anyway, you can go to the Internet Archive or go to the ragblog.com/ragradio, and you can find the podcast for all the shows that we've ever done, including our interview with Scott Crow. All of them are there. Also, and this is interesting, and this is something we're going to talk about and talk about updates on it. For a decade, Scott was targeted for surveillance by the FBI as an alleged domestic terrorist threat without charges being brought. The New York Times characterized Scott as an anarchist, veteran organizer, and an aficionado of civil disobedience. So you're a big fan. The FBI noted in a memo that Crow is a puppet master involved in direct action. And so we're going to have a little puppet show here in a few minutes, but you guys won't be able to see it. And NPR's The American Life called him a living legend among anarchists. His website is www.scottcrow.org.
It's a good thing I don't believe any of that stuff.
I made most of it up, but I thought it sounded cool.
It does.
Okay, Scott. I'm not sure exactly where to start. One thing we're going to talk about, and it's something you wanted to talk about, and it's certainly timely and should be interesting area for us to visit since it's crazy politics season, would be to talk about alternatives to elections and voting, people don't really hear about that much. Sure. I mean, people assume that's the only way you can make decisions in a society, mm-hmm. is through those sort of occasional big money controlled elections between two handpicked parties that have to, I mean, whatever. You know, there's a little bit of a sort of some upstart stuff going on this time, but it's worse than
barely.
I mean, well,
ever.
Donald Trump, you know, where does he fit into anything, any pattern
He's the new Ross Perot.
Is that way? Yeah, he's
or
more
Pat
than
Buchanan.
That. Yeah. Well, he certainly follows in a grand tradition in that sense. But we're going to talk in general, and I think we'll start out. I want you to, you know, I mean, we've talked about this before, but it's basic. I want to know what anarchism means to you and give us a little sense of what's going on right now or in recent times in the anarchist movement. But not only what's going on in the anarchist movement, but what it means in terms of social action and direct action.
Absolutely.
For people who might be listening.
Well, it's an interesting time in a social political world because really, you know, Marxism and then in various forms of communism, socialism dominated the U.S. left for since the early 20th century. But there was a real break at the end of the millennium. And so really what happened was that anarchist and libertarian ideas, when I say libertarian, I mean little libertarian, right. Not Libertarian Party necessarily.
You're not talking Ron Paul?
Not necessarily Ron Paul. Although there are, you know, it's a spectrum that you know, that these are in, so I will give them, you know, like...
I understand.
But really what happened was there was a huge break between the old paradigms, and the liberatory ideas really have risen to the surface through the alternative globalization movement, really, that was around, you know, Seattle in 1999, the G8 summits, all these major summits that were happening were the first time where you were organizing in the streets that a party or an organ didn't try to control everything, and all of a sudden that people began to use these ideas like affinity groups and spokes councils and all of these things that came out of anarchist traditions. I'm not saying anarchists made these up, but these are liberatory things that anarchists use: collective decision making, power sharing, general assemblies, and these became the norm in organizing in the
horizontal.
Absolutely, and just thinking about power sharing and intersectionality, and so really the you know, so the alternative globalization movement kind of went away in the early 2000s in the U.S. And then the anti-war movements really built up, and that same thing happened, and so we saw this rise up, and then we had Hurricane Katrina and the aftermath of that, and then you know the relief efforts that I was part of. Was anarchist, very much anarchist influenced and inspired, and actually I would argue the largest anarchist influenced inspired organization in modern U.S. history.
Well, and there was no government.
There was no government. There was just the people doing things, and you know, and so we use those liberatory ideas, and then you know the succession to come after that were a lot of you know, you had Occupy and Occupy Sandy and all of these liberatory movements that keep rising up. But what happened is that there's more and anarchy. You know, I'll get to the ideas of what anarchy is in the modern world. Is that anarchy used to be that anarchism used to be this basic one set of ideas of mutual aid, cooperation. Direct action, you know, not waiting on others to do something, solidarity, the fact that a collective liberation, that we are all working together to make these things happen. And solidarity being that those of us with access to resources, sharing resources, not in a charity way to have power over, but because our struggles are tied together. So these are basic premises and broad sets of liberatory ideas that have really gained a lot of ground in community organizing and definitely in mass movements in the last 15 years. And it's been pretty inspiring because actually these ideas and the praxis that comes out of them have really just taken on many manifestations. We were talking about a spectrum earlier with libertarians. You know, that's a huge libertarian spectrum between the social leftist end and the more quote-unquote right-leaning individualist end. Between that, there's a huge spectrum of things that are happening. And I've watched nonprofits begin to adopt these things, these ideas, even some corporations. Have adopted some of these ideas, these organizing principles. That doesn't make them anarchists at all, but it's just interesting to see it.
The influence of the concepts. Which,
absolutely. You know, and right now, I talk about the anarchist renaissance. You know, there's there literally is hundreds, or if not thousands, of books in English around about the ideas of anarchy now, and that didn't ever happen before. Even in the heyday of the early 20th century, most books were not in English, you know, because most people weren't English speaking. That were anarchists because they were all immigrants. And so right now we're in this renaissance and there's more websites, there's more people thinking about it, there's been a big, huge culture shift that's been around. And so, but the idea is that, like, anarchy is not like socialism or Marxism or anything. It's not a rigid set of ideologies. It's just a broad set of ideas. It's guideposts to lead us into that we can lead ourselves in to whatever we want it to be. I like to look at it like ecosystems, where all ecosystems have these basic components to them. So like a forest on the west coast or of the United States and a forest on the east coast look very similar from the sky. But when they're just like big trees and all these things. But when you get to them, they're very similar elements, even though they're absolutely different. The trees are different, the flora is different, the fauna is different, but they have these very similar elements to them. Well, that's the way I see the liberatory ideas of anarchy. Is basically they can guide us to this, but there's no party, there's no ideology, there's no rigidity to any of it, because they're living in dynamic practices. And whether we call it anarchy or not, or whether people do call it anarchy or not, matters not to me at all. And I think another thing that's really different about anarchist ideas these days is that I think that many anarchists aren't trying to convert anybody. If these ideas make sense, if these practices, if these institutions that we build make sense, if our direct actions to stop the exploitation and oppression make sense, then people become a part of it. And I think that's a lot different. Within Marxism, there's multiple strains and there's all different kinds. Well, anarchy is the same way. I mean, there's insurrectionary and there's anarcho-syndicalists who want to work on workers' rights stuff. That would be like the Wobblies and things. There's there's the insurrectionary are the people who want to destroy everything. They want chaos. And when I say chaos, I don't mean like mayhem in the streets, but they think that we need to break things down. And because things become too stolidified, too ossified, I guess is the word I'm looking for.
When people want, like, you know, that chaos kind of theory of breaking things down, mm-hmm. is part of that theory then... You break them down and then you build stuff
absolutely.
Based on...
Right, but maybe taking elements from the past.
Right.
But instead of building...
But the idea is that's the only way you're going to get...
Right, and so that's insurrectionary tendencies. We've seen it a lot in Greece recently.
Right.
But the power of anarchy has really gained worldwide because if you look at what's happening in Rojava around... You know, Rojava is the space in between Syria, Iraq, and Iran. Turkey. The Kurdish people have embraced these ideas that Murray Bookchin, one of the anarchist proponents, did, right. and that they've really embraced them, and they're not trying to build a nation state for themselves. They're actually trying to build liberation, collective liberation, in a different way. The Zapatistas, who rose up in Mexico in 1994 and still exist in Chiapas, Mexico, don't call themselves anarchist in any mean, but the liberatory ideas are there, and what they're doing are very similar to what's happening. And this is going on all over the world. I mean, the MST movement, the landless peasant movement in Brazil. It's not isolated just to North America, the United States, or Mexico, or any of these places. It's all over the world. And it's kind of exciting to see living dynamic ideas.
I should think that probably the phenomenon that maybe reached the public most dramatically in recent was the Occupy movement.
Absolutely. Because when people came into Occupy, they came into anarchist ideas without even knowing what they were. It's just the practices, building, you know, medical tents, having street medics, having free libraries, food not bombs, feeding people. These are all the same things that we did at Common Ground, that we brought in dual power to resist oppression and exploitation on one hand, but we also wanted to build and create on the other hand, which is exactly what Occupy did. Except it was the beautiful thing was there was no party organ that really tried to control it at the beginning, before the Democratic Party or various strains of communist parties would try to control it. They couldn't control it because there was already these liberatory frameworks that were happening. And Occupy was beautiful. It was a beautiful train wreck, like everything is, because we're all getting to practice in doing this. None of us are born. I think we're all born anarchist, but I think that gets beat out of us, you know, to not just conform, but to be in the capitalist system, to be in economic systems that are exploitative.
But you didn't. Nobody was going. But there wasn't a book that
there was
people
not
were looking at. Let's see now. What do we do next?
No,
there's no outline.
But
I mean, I'm kidding.
No, but it's true, right? Which was a beautiful thing. Yeah. But people are like, well, we'll draw from this tradition or that tradition.
Right,
and again,
right.
like anarchy is not a brand. It's not an ideology that it, you know, like anarchist many anarchist practices come from other traditions and other things. And you know, like have as, if you really want to go back before the Western world, you talk about indigenous roots. You know,
right? We're working on a book. It's going to be the 50th anniversary of the RAG, the underground newspaper that we started in 1966. And in October, we're going to have all these events. And one of the things we're doing is we're putting together a book. And so we're going back and reading through all the old rags, because part of the book is going to be sort of a best of compendium. And I was reading an article that Gary Thayer wrote about Woodstock, at Woodstock, and talking about how you know, I mean, there were twice as many people as were expected. They had all the, you know, they didn't have the supplies, and people just built their city, built their communities. And Burning Man kind of is the
exactly,
same kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
And that's something people can relate to understand, I think, how...
Just self-organization. Anytime right. that we take governments or corporations out of the equation and begin to rely on ourselves, that's when we begin to open up those worlds.
Okay, we're talking with Scott Crowe. We're talking about anarchism and related phenomena. I ain't trying to bring back the rap scene, trying to bring back raps to bring back the guillotine. Whether it's the world or my flow, this is sickest OCD with my ADHD. Exactly how Bill Gates raised me to be. Everywhere at once, nowhere to be found. I'm in the air, to underground, for the underground. Focus, one man swarm a locust. Ruthless critique and pain, one makes the opus. Try not to get dragged to the mud within. But you know, sometimes a little mud is good for the skin. Hands are on fire, I write to put it out. No label, no boss, life work to put it out. Keep them bloodsuckers out of my life. Healthy fear, only way to survive. The death drive. The industry is fake, pay to play in your hearses. Twitter ass kisses trying to buy verses. You rap like your man and your man rap like you got that unseen hand up his back. Make him sing like evil's a ventriloquist. The lifestyle you sell made the world a living hell. But it's better than a jail. Trigger warning, I might blast you if you stand between me and greener pastures. I don't want it all, but I want enough. In 2014, that seems just asking too much. The wine and the moan, the only way to survive. The death drive. Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. Scott Crowe is with us, and we're going to talk. We've been talking about anarchism so far, which is sort of an interesting topic or a relevant topic to talk about, since Scott is a proponent and active participant in or practitioner of anarchist.
But again,
kind of
you know, I want to be clear about that, though. It's not a, like, you know, anarchist is the shorthand, you know. It's actually something I engage in. But, you know, I'm a father and a
I know.
A neighbor and all this.
A musician.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I understand that. It's an approach to life.
Absolutely.
It's an approach to life, which is a great opportunity to transition into the cooperative movement. Mm-hmm. How important is it? How extensive is it? How much is it growing? How radical is it?
Mm. You know, many questions about co-ops. There's a lot of so co-ops have a lot of liberatory elements to them. They're a good step in the right direction, and trying to step away from the tendency towards hierarchy and having power over, because you begin to power share in it. It begins to bring people together face to face. And co-ops in general, there's many kinds of co-ops. You know, there's credit unions, there's consumer co-ops, agricultural co-ops, worker co-ops, housing. I mean, we could go down the list. Some of them are much more egalitarian and liberatory than others are. You know, some consumer co-ops have a liberatory element to them. And I'm using the word liberatory. You could replace the word with revolutionary, whatever it is. But they all have something in common, which is that they're striving for something that's outside of capitalism while capitalism still exists. So, and you know, there's all, like I said, there's all different kinds. I personally have focused on a lot of worker co-ops because I believe they have the most liberatory elements. I've built numerous worker co-ops and I've built them all horizontal along the way. Because I like working with people, and you know, it's one of the things that we all engage in is work under these systems. You know, most of us have to work, and so I realized when I was about 17 that I couldn't work for people. I was terrible at it, but I'm great at working with people. And so I started to figure out what that was. And so, you know, it's been a 25-year process of trying to figure that out, making a lot of mistakes along the way. But I think that co-ops are a really good way for us to think about it, because it begins to think about not just the individual, but also how we could work together as groups of people, but also how we have, how, you know, generally co-ops are much more locally focused when they can be. And so they also are care about the multiple communities around them, the environment that's around them, all these different levels that many corporations give lip service to, but can't ever actually really do. And they also are hyper-localized generally. And that's a really good thing. You can't franchise co-ops. The co-ops to me are not the answer, but they're a step in the direction. And they also, we need alternatives. We need counter institutions under capitalism. But what happens often is that when people start co-ops and the old co-op movements in the beginning is they were very liberatory when they rose up, but then they just become kind of insular, places and comfortable beds of radicalism. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, isn't that a problem though?
It's a huge problem.
It's a problem in general with any institution.
Absolutely.
That gets created, whether it's horizontal or whatever.
Right.
That's why the revolution has to be a continuing process.
Right, a living revolution, living and dynamic, which I think is absolutely important. Because revolution is not about all about guns, guts, and glory. The self-actualization of actually, like, really, what does it mean to be free for myself? And then what does it mean to be free for those around us? And so what happens a lot of times with co-ops and other counter institutions is they just get comfortable where they are. That's what happened with Burning Man, and then it just largely became corporate. Yeah. Now, I'm not saying that everybody's experience that goes to Burning Man is like that, or any of the other ones. There's many other elements, and I think it is as much of a living embodiment as you can. It's got some liberatory potential, and it's still, but not everything around it is.
Right. Right.
And so I think that, but what I would like us to do is to begin to build them much more, build co-ops consciously with this liberatory analysis. And here in Austin, we have done that. Like Ecology Action, a long-standing, the oldest worker co-op, but also one of the oldest environmental organization in Texas, 1970, became a worker cooperative again in 2000. And then I was part of that for 6.5 years. And we actually built it with liberatory potential. So it was a horizontally organized workplace, horizontal everything. And then we thought about what did it mean for us to engage as a local organization internationally with trash, basically, because there's a giant recycling center, with stuff that was not very ethical, that it had nothing to do with us because of the systems that are in place. And along the way, we decided we needed to build a thrift store. And so in 2004, I wrote a proposal, but then we put it into action in 2006, and we built Treasure City Thrift, which is a horizontally organized cooperative. They employ mostly women, living wage, to work there, and we give away thousands of dollars a month to projects like Inside Books and other local projects, as well as material aid. And these are, and when Ecology Action was still functioning and doing recycling downtown and the Treasure City, you know, we were using these as springboards to do multiple things, to keep stuff out of the waste stream, to fund projects that without, you know, like, but not like a traditional funder. So,
right.
So again, these are things that these were opening doors for liberatory potential.
Okay, before we move on, there's all these concepts, like sharing economy, gift economy. What about those kind of new age, not new age exactly, but...
No, they're not new age. I mean, corporations have absorbed them very, very well, because they're not very liberatory whatsoever. The gift economy as a concept, absolutely liberatory, right?
Yeah.
But the enactments of it, not necessarily always liberatory,
right.
Because it usually has happened with people with already access to resources, you know, education, money, safe housing, and things like that. Those are the people who are generally engaging that. And I'm not saying that not to knock that down, but it leaves out marginalized communities all over the place. And there's so many people who are left out of these things. And then you have things that are called sharing economy that are just basic capitalism. You're talking about the ride sharing places, the housing stuff, like, I don't even want to name the brands because everybody knows what they are.
Right.
They are not, they are sharing economies, but they're also just micro capitalism that are basically making serfs out of the people who participate in them, while they hear stories about the other people who make tons of money out of it. But the corporation ultimately is making the money.
Yeah. Really,
and causing a lot of issues, you know, housing issues and issues around transportation and unions and stuff, you know, like, and again, I'm all about us trying out ideas, but let's don't confuse them, you know,
and let's not just assume that we're above above the things that other people have to deal with.
Exactly. Like, know, listen, it's not we hold our breath until utopia is here,
because
that's never going to happen. We're all going to die from holding our breath by the time that happens, you know? So.
Yeah, but it, you know, utopia is a concept that we can always hold out there.
Well, why not dream of that? Yeah. But the other piece of this I would like to say, too, is that remember that no systematic market can reform anything. Capitalism, socialism, communism, none of those as markets are liberatory. They are what they are. What's going to make us free is cultural shifts and the politics and the engagements and the way that people engage in STEM locally are the things that are going to make us free. And then we figure out if we want to have a gift economy and what does a real gift economy look like.
Okay. All right. Politics.
Politics?
Politics. Politricksters.
Absolutely.
Tell us, you believe strongly in not utilizing our traditional electoral system. What are the alternatives? What do you recommend to people? What do you suggest as an alternative?
Let me back up for 1 second. That I have worked in electoral politics for a long time.
Yes.
I didn't give up on electoral politics until about 2000. Actually, Roger and I worked together in the Green Party for a long time, 2001. I actually worked for Ralph Nader's campaign, even though I was far out of electoral politics, in 2004 again as a consultant. So I have a lot of history within it, working within the parties. I definitely understand it, and as well as communist parties too, before I was an anarchist. And so what I realized along the way in all these engagements that I have is that we're more than voters. We're more than consumers. And actually what I've realized in the last 10 or 15 years is that we're more than just activists too. So there's all these spaces in between in that spectrum that we haven't even begun to really explore that much. I think Occupy opened the crack in history. Common Ground, the disaster relief stuff after Hurricane Katrina, opened that crack in history. Like the Zapatistas International and Rojava. These are beginning to show us glimpses of alternatives that we might want to live in. So with that, what I am proposing is that that we don't just boycott elections. We actually say what they are is that we make them that they're irrelevant. And I don't, you know, like people can have tried to argue me out of this for a long time. I can go down a long thesis on why politics doesn't work, but I don't want to because many people and voting doesn't work. And I can go down a long rabbit hole with that. But you know what? There's tons of people have written about it. So if you just look it up. Now, that said, I'm not saying don't vote. I'm saying if you're not going to do anything else, the least you can do is recycle and vote, you know, but don't hold it as higher moral authority that you're doing something that nobody else is doing because you're not doing anything. You're making yourself feel good. And actually in social media, it was so frustrating because I was getting emails from people and they're like, aren't you going to vote? You should vote. This is the time to vote. And I was like, you know what? My time is better spent walking my dog today on a voting day. So that said, I'm not saying, again, I want to be clear, if that's what you're going to do, just do it. But there's so many alternatives and I want us to explore them, even if we don't know the outcomes or what the answers are. And that's a hard thing to do because we want to say, well, if you're against this, you must offer this. Well, I have some things, but the framing of it I want to talk about is dual power.
Okay.
If I can do it.
Yes. Before you do that, one question. Do you not believe, and I understand the concept about politics being essentially irrelevant, or I added the essentially part.
Mm-hmm.
But do you not think that there are things that happen in politics that make concrete differences in people's lives that wouldn't happen otherwise, that make life more livable for a lot of people, especially people in poverty, especially people of color? Makes a difference.
That's the leftist line that we always carry, right?
Yes, but answer to it?
But think about this: when the scraps that make it good for those things are healthcare, education. I have Obamacare. I don't live under a rock. You know, like I don't live in some utopia land. Again, I'm not holding my breath until. But all the small gains that we can still have under those, let's just pick the last 40 years, corporations have gotten way more. Why? There's more prisons now than there ever was. The wall that they're building between us and Mexico, the abomination of a wall, is way bigger than it ever was under Ronald Reagan or anything 30 years ago. Nuclear war, there's more weapons to kill us now than there were. We are way more, I mean, there, you know, that argument doesn't hold out to me because for the small gains, because those small but important gains that happen are important. I won't say that. So if all you can do is pull a lever one day a year, do it for, and you can
you're
do it for us.
You're acknowledging then that that can make an actual difference.
But it's,
you have to look at the larger
perspective. But it's like using, somebody compared it to using social media. So, social media has a lot of advantages to it, right? We can communicate easily and stuff like that. But there's a cost to it, right? Because you are a product, right? So I'm not saying that we're a product in the electoral system, but there's a lot you have to judge what all the other stuff that we're not getting, that we are losing ground on. Because corporations are more powerful than they've ever been, thanks to government. And governments are much more centralized again than they've ever been in the United States. I'm not speaking globally. I'm just talking about the U.S., So, again, things like the war on drugs, the war on terror, those things win way more money, billions and billions of dollars, versus any small gains in transportation, healthcare, education, or immigration bills. And so that's why, why cling to scraps? What I'm saying is what if we began to take a leap of faith, if you want to call it that, but it's not blind faith. It's actually strategically and say, we will make a break with this and we want to try something else, even if we don't know what the answers of those are. When we started Common Ground and after Hurricane Katrina in 2005, there was no blueprint for it. But all we could do was draw on the histories that had come before us and then see what we could do to build on that. We said, yeah, we want healthcare and education, so we could either appeal to FEMA and Red Cross and all those things, or we can start to build healthcare and education ourselves, but we can also stop the police from killing black and brown people on the street at the same time. They were not mutually exclusive.
Scott Crow is my guest on RAG Radio. And it's a dynamic discussion. And I love having you here. I love always talking with you, whether it's on the air or not.
I do too.
Okay. But now we're taking a break. To you, Tracy Schultz.
Yes, that's a little bit of our friends, the Melancholy Ramblers, who was here in the studios a couple of weeks ago.
And we have to say that Marco Perella's original piece, The Anarchist's Ball, is on that CD right there.
Love that.
So, way cool.
Very well done.
Okay, Scott Crow is our guest, and Scott is an author, is a practitioner, proponent of anarchist concepts and ideas. Is a musician, a filmmaker, has been commentator in many areas, has a wide-ranging resume, was involved in the amazing Common Ground Collective in New Orleans during Katrina, was a prime mover behind that whole thing. We're talking pretty much about... We're talking from an anarchist perspective. We've been talking about electoral politics. In fact, you were at a point where you wanted to go off into. Do you remember what you?
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about dual power.
About dual power. That's
so.
What it was.
So basically, one of the alternatives is to begin to think differently about what do we want and how do we want to get there. And, other movements have done this in the past. The Black Panther Party did it. They came up with what we want and what we believe. And so, but basically the framing of what I would like us to begin to think about is moving from politics of opposition to a politics and engagements of possibilities. So instead of just voting for the lesser guy, buying this thing because so they won't do something terrible, this corporation won't do something terrible, or just engaging in protests in the streets, that we begin to say, well, we know that stuff is bad. And if we want war to stop, whether it's war on women, war on trans people, war on animals, the planet, or international wars, that we begin to create the worlds that we want to live in. And I don't mean like isolated pockets of white people who have lots of money. I'm talking about for everybody, that we begin to think of this. And so we begin to move towards politics of possibilities and engagements of possibilities, and we begin to think outside of electoral politics systems, consumer systems, and activism, and begin to go, what is it that we want, and how do we want to get there? And that begins to frame things differently. When I don't have to vote for the lesser guy, or I don't just have to protest against something, you begin to open this space where you say, well, what is it I do want, and then how do I want to get there? Not just me, but how is it that we can collectively get there? And so the framing of it I call dual power, which has nothing to do with Trotsky's dual power whatsoever, but it's right. Basically resisting on one hand and then creating and building on the other hand.
Right, right. Which is kind of basic, and it's and in a lot of ways it's what we were looking at in SDS.
Absolutely.
In the 60s.
I didn't make any of this stuff up. I'm definitely just drawing from other traditions and other histories.
But that's all we can do. Nothing's new, right?
Let's remix this stuff. Yeah, exactly.
It's a remix.
Right.
So, music. How long have you been involved in music?
And well, I just got back into music again, but it's interesting because I'd actually fallen out of it in about 1992, after we did a couple of records. I was in industrial music back then from the late 80s and the early 90s. My band, we toured with bands like Nine Inch Nails and Skinny Puppy, and we played with bands like Ministry and Thrill Kill Cult and Dwarves Out, all these industrial bands.
I just don't ever want Nine Inch Nails and Skinny Puppies to run into each other. That just bothers me.
But more recently, I've been engaging with culture makers a lot more, filmmakers again, and artists of different stripes. And so what I've been doing is I've been opening shows for hip-hop artists and stuff. And I'm not doing spoken word. I just basically get up and do a presentation about anarchy ideas and about the politics of possibilities. But I do it fast and engaging with all of these imagery and stuff. So I've kind of gotten my feet wet again. And
you
like,
pretty much do everything fast and engaging.
So. I can't have it either way. People are like, are you nervous? I'm like, no, that's just regular. Except when I'm asleep. And but like last year, I opened up for Propagandhi at Mohawk, and I opened up for this hip-hop artist called Soul. And then recently, I just started to work with Soul on a new track, and I just cut a track with him and the guys from Propagandhi, who are a Canadian political band that's been around for 20 years. We just cut a track together. And, you know, and I like that. I like the engagement of working with culture makers to think about things, because I think that politics is dry and boring, actually.
Okay, the New York Times ran a big feature story. I believe it was a front page.
Yeah, it was.
Front page feature story on you in relation to the fact that you had been subject to surveillance by the FBI for, I guess, what?
Almost 10 years.
Almost 10 years at that time. Uh-huh. And how much were you aware of it, by the way?
You know, in activist world, especially
you always sort of are aware of
right, exactly. It's always there, but it's always hard to sort the reality versus what you think it is or what your friends think it is. But there were some very clear signs. Like I stopped being able to fly very well about 2003, 2004, and I stopped getting on planes in 2006 because I could not get on a plane. So that was a big indicator. Another thing is I visited people who were political prisoners called the Angola Three in Angola, Louisiana. I'd visit them for about 5 or 6 years in prison, and I was unceremoniously kicked off of their list to visit them due to information received from the FBI. And that happened in 2006. So, and that information that they said was that I was an alleged domestic terrorist, I was an alleged animal rights extremist, and environmental terrorist. Those were the words they used. Now, no charges were ever brought, and I still didn't get the documents for a long time. But all during this time, there were people sitting in front of my house for about 4 years, and it was different. It really was a Joint Terrorism Task Force. It wasn't just the FBI. So it was, you know, it's actually UT Police, the University of Texas Police. It was the Sheriff's Department. And they would change out, and the FBI was also an APD, the Austin Police Department. So so they sat out, and we would always make fun of it. So finally, some people in a group. A legal collective did some FOIAs for me and a bunch of other people, and I came back with 1,200 pages of documents, which seemed like a lot at the time, but now I'm in a lawsuit with them, and I think I'm going to get about 10,000 pages. My partner, Anne, only got 300 pages the first round, and they said there's 4,000 pages for her this time. So But these people would sit in front of our house, and they were taking great information like this. White male, shirtless, working in garden. Now, somebody's pulling $130,000, $150,000 a year to write this. White male rides easterly on his bike. You know how many pages that appeared on? It's because I was riding my bike. You know. So, yeah. I mean, this is government taxes at work. You know.
But was it a red bike?
Of course it was.
Okay, so they're in there.
So, but the surveillance was pretty serious, and it kind of came on the heels. My story broke. What was unusual about my story is not just it was the level of the surveillance, but also the fact that I didn't go to prison. Because usually by the time they release, they have done that deep of research for that long, they're getting convictions.
They're actually coming up with something.
Exactly. And they tried to indict me for three different things during that time. One was having a stockpile of weapons. But I'm like, I'm from Texas. I have two guns. That's not a stockpile. And then also being a nexus of terrorism, saying that I was taking international funds and funding domestic terrorism. And then the third thing was all these unsolved arsons and property destruction related to the Animal Liberation Front and the Earth Liberation Front, which they were desperately trying to solve at that point. And they tried to pin quite a few of them on me. And again, showing how terrible their information was, they were alleging that I was in two different places at the same time that were states that were not co-joining.
When you were really no place at all.
Sorry. Absolutely. I was at home. Yeah. So this is the kind of thing that was happening. But what happened is when the Times did the piece, my story, not because I'm important, I don't think I'm important because of this. I think I just fit the profile of everything. I was an anarchist. I was animal liberation, I fight for animal liberation and environmental stuff for 30 years. These are things that, besides being Muslim, that were the top domestic priority. Now, and to put that in perspective, too, that we have to understand that Muslim people are by far the ones that are the target under the war on terror, and I could never take that away. 95-98% of the cases, even domestically, are related to them. Activist cases make up much less than that. But, you know, they spent this amazing amount of resources, and they still got nothing. But what happened was that my story was able to gain traction to be able to... To be able to uncover the surveillance industry, the beginning of it. Not the beginnings of it, but that this was happening. And so that's why the Times wanted the story. And I worked with them for about 10 months on that story. You know, like I say, work with them. They didn't consult me, but just talking to them about it, being interviewed for it. It took a long time. And then until Snowden's stuff broke in 2013, that was the biggest story that really was showing stuff, although other things were starting to bubble up. And now, you know, thanks to Snowden and all these other stories, and we're now able to see the depth of the surveillance state in the
Do you think the Times did a good job on that?
Times job on it.
Yeah, but that can be the Times job can mean a number of different things.
It becomes a story of record. Is it the truth? It is the truth as they know it.
Okay. All right.
You know, I mean, like it happened. I mean, the documents happened from 1999 to 2008 or 9. But they only wanted to cover three or four years, and that's what they said happened. But really, I have documents on both sides. I mean, they're confirmed documents. But that's not the story they wanted to write. So, like, that kind of, like, minutia of that. But, yeah, I think they got it right. Because the FBI really did, I just fit the profile, and they really wanted me bad. And, again, not because I'm so powerful. I think it just justified the budgets, you know, of what they were doing.
Yeah. So are they watching you now?
Well, that's a good question.
I just saw a big guy come in. Oh, no, wait, that was Kim Simpson. Sorry.
Okay. You know, here's why I'm in a lawsuit with the Department of Homeland Security. Some really good friends of mine, Will Potter, Ryan Shapiro, Jeffrey Light, these are lawyers and activists who have really just unraveled the FOIA system, the Freedom of Information Act. They have just rewritten the rules, and the FBI and Department of Homeland Security hates their guts. So we resubmitted under the new guidelines that they have used to get information, which is why we're getting much more documents. But I want to see all of this stuff come to light, not just my case, but all the stuff that's related to it, because they're doing it they're doing lawsuits on multiples of us. There's hundreds of us that have been targeted this, because we want it to end. We don't want the funding to keep going, especially in Muslim communities, you know. So as much as we can expose on it, in fact, the FBI was so scared, they issued an ex parte letter in the lawsuit, so meaning basically they could show the information to the judge, but the defendants can't see it, yeah, of why they should not release the documents.
Yeah. Well, you're a youngster, but those of us who were involved here in the 60s and 70s, you know, were under continual surveillance, and a lot of that came out. We got a lot of documents
absolutely
that showed it was true, and then in that context, the whole COINTELPRO phenomenon grew, and then there were multiple agencies, and I mean, there was provocateur stuff. There were,
absolutely.
There were assassinations.
I mean, George Vizard, I mean, that story is heartbreaking.
Yeah. You know? So there's all kinds of stuff that went on, and you didn't know. I mean, then the Freedom of Information Act allowed people to find out so much of that.
But then they reined it in.
Then they reined it in.
And so now we're trying to open it back up because we're smarter than they are.
Right.
Our lawyers are smarter than their lawyers, I promise you.
Well, that's always good to know. We might.
Hey, listen, just because they're big doesn't mean that they're smart. I just want everybody to remember that. And this, I want to say this about surveillance, because we often talk about the negative aspects and people get paranoid around it. Listen, it doesn't matter. Just do what you're going to do. I don't live paranoid. I have great relationships. Six informants in my life. Two of them tried to get me to commit crimes that would have put me in prison for 40 years each time. And they were not targets that I wanted to be a part of. So I said no. But luckily I did, because they were FBI informants. And you know, so I'm able to stand here now. But even with that, I still trust people every day. You know, they don't know everything. No matter, we think they know everything. Actually, Facebook and Google and Apple each
know more about,
absolutely. Yeah. They, you know, than the feds
do. The paradigm has
absolutely
changed.
Absolutely. And even what they sell to you, you know, as long as siloed right now, but you know, like the FBI doesn't have it. They haven't caught up to that. Right. And the NSA even, right. You know.
When we talked about the New York Times and the role it played, and you talked about, you know, what about media in general? What about the role of alternative media? The media obviously defines the terms in so many ways in our society.
I tried to help shape that story as best I could. Now, this is working with two reporters that I don't know, who have just interviewed me before for other things around surveillance. And but I really tried to shape the story. I consciously thought about shaping the story because I wanted two things. Okay, I wanted anarchy to look reasonable, me to look reasonable, and actually the third thing is I wanted the FBI to look like the idiots they were. Right. And so we were able to do that. Culture shift through media is incredibly important, not just alternative media, but corporate media too. We should always be working it to tell the narratives, because we're fighting against PR firms who are invisible in doing this, as well as corporate mouthpieces. So always working the media is important. Just be strategic about it. And it's not about the truth on their end, so make it about being right.
Okay. Tell us what you're working on now. Tell us what's coming up. Scott Crowe.
I'm working on a few books, actually. That's the biggest thing I'm doing. Mostly what I do now is I end up traveling a lot, speaking at colleges, churches, and community spaces around the world. But mostly what I'm doing is I work with a project called Agency, which is an anarchist PR firm. There's no pay. It's just a volunteer thing. I do a lot of mentoring with people. I'm working with quite a few people on first-time writers on getting their revolutionary books out and liberatory books. And I'm trying to write. I don't consider myself an activist anymore in the traditional sense. My thing is to shift culture. I really want to think about ideas and moving things. And you know, like what I do day-to-day is like I walk my dog. I try to enjoy some life. There's a short time on this planet, and I can't always focus on the negative, because I want to engage in the politics of possibilities.
And you ride that red bicycle.
Dang right. It's silver now, though.
Oh, well. That's all right, I guess. www.scottcrowe.org. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. I always enjoy it, Thorne. Love being on the show. Thank you, Tracy, so much.
Oh, cool. Oh, my pleasure.
I want to thank everybody for being with us. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio. Coming up, UT Austin's Julia Mickenberg, Richard Reddick, and Kate Cattrell, author and Kent State survivor Thomas Grace, and Tom Hayden and Barbara Williams.